just going to, we're not going to pause.
We're actually rolling now.
Okay. Well,
let's see how your levels are.
Hello.
Yeah, one, two, amazing. You know.
One, two, three. Is that too much?
Yeah, but just on my end.
Okay.
So let's, we're going to jump in. This is a special Sidewalk Radio Extra because I'm getting a hang with my friend, collaborator, conspirator, Dr. Chip Cole. Thank you.
Well, I'm so glad to be here. I appreciate the opportunity, Gene.
Yeah. Well, should we start by giving laudatory remarks about me?
Yeah.
No, let's tell people how we met, and then we'll get into you. We've got a whole hour for you.
Okay. But. Well, this is a pretty funny story. Back when Gene had, let's see, it was, I think, Kansas PR firm or ad agency. He came in, 20-something punk and jeans and a T-shirt, and everybody else had a fancy presentation, but Gene had all the great ideas, and I immediately bonded with him. We both have a New Orleans connection, and the person I was working with at the time said, well, there's three people we looked at. One person I know for sure is not that Kansas guy. And I said, no, it's just the opposite. I like his energy, enthusiasm, creativity. And I went with you. And ever since then, we've been good friends and comrades.
Yeah, well, thank you for selecting me. But it was kind of like one of those things where we got along instantly. And we've come a pretty long way together. I mean, not just like through professional stuff, but there's been marriages and kids and now grandkids. And I think that might be a nice way to start just with our listeners getting to learn about you, is talking about family, kind of where you came from, hearing about how you and Susan met and getting into family. And then we'll go into the rest of the stuff.
Sure. We joke around and say we statistically don't exist because we met in junior high. And she was 7th grade, I was 8th grade, and she was cute, had bangs and braces, and we went and played putt-putt. That was our first date, and she beat me, of course, and I thought, you know, this girl's got a lot of spunk. And so we've pretty much been together ever since, and so we moved about 12 times.
Now, hold on one sec. How long have y'all been together?
So we've been together.
For those math majors out there.
Yeah, so we've been together like 41 years.
My God. And
I 33 mean, of it married.
That is, you know, Deanna and I just celebrated a year, which has been, it's been a big year and a great year. But that's a pretty short amount of time compared to 33, 41.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that I, plus others out there, would like to know the secret.
Well, the secret, I think, is kind of being good friends and communicating a lot. You know, we certainly talk a lot in the evenings and kind of share each other's thoughts. And I think that's been real nice. I was fortunate that she went into nursing, and I think that helps because she knows all about the demands of the medical profession.
Well, yeah, that's actually, I'm glad you mentioned that because we should tell people real quick, like who you are and what you do, and then we can get back to the family story.
Yeah, I'm an oculoplastic surgeon, quadruple board certified. And so I specialize in both a combination of ophthalmology and plastic surgery. So I exclusively focus on the face and in the mid part of the face as well.
But when you started, if I remember correctly, and this has been maybe a decade since we really had the conversation, but you wanted to be an architect, right?
That's right. My first love was mechanical drawing, and I'm a very detailed guy. I like all those millimeters, and I liked, you know, I would design things. I even went to like a state competition, and that's what I planned to do when I really started to think about college was be an architect.
Because a lot of our listeners are into architecture and culture and design, so I think it's kind of fun, and we'll get back to it a little bit later about maybe some of the similarities between oculoplastic surgery and architecture. It could be fun to discuss, but back to the story of the family. So you and Susan met. And
so then we met and dated through high school. You know, then we kind of went to the same college, and then she pursued nursing, and I went the medical route, and she became a neonatal nurse practitioner, which is working with the little preemies and you know, the little babies that you can hold in one hand that get born early. And she did that for about 12 years. And one night I got called into the emergency room and I snuck off so I wouldn't wake her up. And then she got called for delivery, and then she kind of got ready real quietly and went to go tell me she was leaving, and I was gone. And so we had three small kids and nobody to take care of them in the middle of the night. So we thought that's a good time for her to stop work.
Yeah. So she appreciated that.
So she retired. And,
But it's also like nursing and medical is all in the family. I mean, your mom is a nurse too, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Your daughter.
My sister is a nurse. My mother is a nurse. My wife's a nurse. My daughter's a nurse. So I like to say I give a lot of second opinions around the house.
That's fun. So tell us about the three kids that were sleeping there that night.
Well, I've got my oldest is Chris, a boy. My middle is a daughter, Allison. My youngest is Tyler. And they were all born fairly close in New Orleans. There's about 3.5 years between the three of them.
Well, here's something that I'm already picking up as a similarity between architects and surgeons. You both work a lot.
Yes.
And you have to study a lot. But you've done one of the greatest jobs of anyone I know in spending time for family. So how did you do that both in like preparing through residency, becoming a doctor, and now, you know, as an established?
When I was growing up in Louisiana, my parents, Penny and Muggsy, and Muggsy's the mom and Penny's the dad. Family was always very important to us, and we spent a lot of time together. And so I think in my upbringing, I saw the importance and felt the importance and the love of my own family. And so that was something that was always a big deal to Susan and I. And it does take some effort, but, you know, we try to do things like, we call it UP, always being unplugged, you know, at home. When we have dinner, you know, nobody can answer the phone, and we would literally sit around and talk for like an hour having dinner. And so we certainly made an effort. You know, everybody's super busy, and including kids. And I think if you don't make an effort to do things together, it's very easy to lose connection.
Yeah. So we watched, have you seen the Billy Crystal special, 700 Sundays?
No, I haven't.
First of all, it's amazing. It's, I think, a Tony Award-winning play that is on HBO right now. But his father died when he was 15. And he calculated that during his lifetime, he had 700 Sundays with his dad.
Wow.
And telling the story about how that's not enough, but it was. And a lot about, like, life and the hand you're dealt, and when you think you really have a bad hand, you look back at everything else, it might be a very good hand. And he does it in only the way that Billy Crystal can, in like the humor and the acting and like the personal history, but it's also a history lesson, and the whole thing's amazing. When you think about it, it's like, you don't have to spend all day long with your family, but like dedicating that time, like even if it's the hour at dinner, those hours can add up and it means a lot.
Right. No, I agree. And I do think the cliche, you know, it's quality over quantity is probably overused. But, you know, there's a lot to be said for being there, you know, the first time, you know, they're at a play or the first basket they make. And, you know, I know for myself, I was a Cub Scout leader with all the kids. I coached them all in basketball. And I feel like all those things. Even now, I'll talk to their friends, and it's been, you know, 15 years, and they still remember, you know, those basketball games and that type of thing. And, I do think it's what I call the magic moments that make a difference.
Yeah. You just came out with a new book. And, you know, you're pretty modest, so I'll just let people know. I mean, you're really good at what you do. You're in the top five in the country. And, you know, you write this book and people want to read it, and, you know, you would think, oh, it's going to be just about plastic surgery and medical and how to, you know, take a look at this. But it's about a lot more than that. Will you tell people about the book and then kind of how you feel it relates to your life and why you wrote it?
Sure. You know, my motivation for writing the book was, you know, my kids went through some struggles as teenagers, like a lot of kids do in these times. And I think that no matter how much love and support you give kids, their peers kind of take over when they're about 12. And so you really got to try hard. And my youngest son, one of his very best friends, had an accident, basically an accidental overdose. And it was very tragic to not only that family, but our family and everybody we know. And it really hit home to me that there's a lot of troubled teens out there that either don't have the help that they need or it's not recognized by their parents. And I think that's a kind of a group in society that gets missed or gets underfunded and overlooked by government programs and things like that. So I wanted to do this as a project to not only educate people, but also give an opportunity that if somebody wanted to have surgery and wanted to do anything to improve themselves, that they could also improve young teens and troubled teens at the same time. Basically, kind of a way to pay it forward.
And is that why, is that kind of double entendre the reason that you named the book Face Change?
Absolutely. And so I also named the book Face Change, and I started a foundation named Face Change as well. And it's exactly what the goal was. So far, it's been very well received. We've been able to raise over $300,000 that we've put toward these troubled teens.
Well, look, I'm a 41-year-old dude, and you know, you gave me the manuscript even before it even got published. And I mean, we're good friends, so I thought I'll read it like almost out of obligation. And I got kind of hooked. Now, I was surprised by that because I didn't think that I would really care that much about like this book about how to make myself look better. But I found out pretty quickly it wasn't just about that. Why don't you share with people why you think a 41-year-old guy would care about it just as much as a 20-year-old girl or a 70-year-old woman?
Sure. Well, one thing I did is I tried to make it interesting to all different groups because as a teenager, you know, you're going through changes, you're separating a little independence from your parents, and I tried to include things that talk specifically to that group. And then as people get older, their interest changes and you know, let's face it, gravity is awake, you know, 24/7. So by the time you get to be middle age, you've got a lot of concerns that you didn't have when you were a teenager. And so each chapter has different options and interests of people depending on where they are kind of in the spectrum of life. And then, of course, I put in a male chapter, which I think probably was the most interesting for you, because there's a lot of things that men don't really think about. And, you know, I like to say real men, you know, do eat quiche and they also get their nails done every once in a while. There's nothing wrong with us He-Man guys taking care of ourselves.
Well, I mean, a few of the things that really kind of hit home were on the how to eat and how to hydrate and drinking plenty of water and things that, you know, I didn't feel like my masculinity was at risk by doing. No, you know, I'm kind of kidding around. Like, you know, my sister would say that, my brother's a metrosexual. Fine. But like, you know, people do care about the way they look. But as you get older, or as I got older, like, I also realized that I would like to stick around. And I would like to do that feeling well.
Yeah, and that's something that I think comes with, you know, maturity and some wisdom. You know, I joke around that when I was young, I looked very young for where I was in the profession. So I grew a beard trying to look older. And then as I got older, I feel like I'm afraid to shave off my beard because I might look so old underneath it. So, you know,
you look young.
Unless you have the luxury of a beard like I do, you know, it's really a big deal as you get older, taking care of yourself. Because, you know, whether it's sun damage as a teenager before you know it, or, you know, a lot of people have kind of, you know, experimented with a few things, smoking and things like that in college and high school. And then a lot of times people realize that it not only has a big effect on your health, but it has an effect on your external appearance. So one thing I really tried to emphasize in the book is that it's all about internal and external health. It's not just, you know, the cover of the book, it's what's inside the book as well.
So your business is, it's not only important to you and your patients for privacy, but it's also important to the government, right?
So absolutely.
You know, I know that you can't talk about certain patients, and that's fine. You know, when people come in to see you, sometimes they're under duress, and sometimes, like, you know, making these big decisions, like to even improve your look, it may not be the right time, right? I mean, how do you have these conversations with people, and what are you on the lookout for with that?
Sure. Well, a lot of times people will want to make changes when they're going through some very stressful events, like a divorce is a very common example. And, you know, a divorce is very hard for anybody, no matter how amicable we feel like it is or they do. And so that's a common one. And I always like people to go through a little bit of the grieving and acceptance part before they consider a surgical change. A better example of when it's really needed is sometimes thinking about, you know, the troubled teens, people will be the subject of bullying. Just about 2 weeks ago, I had a patient that had what I call Obama ears. And I think everybody knows what I mean by that. The big ears, like tilting forward, and they get teased a lot. You know, kids and teenagers are tough. And I was able to recontour the ears and pin them back surgically to where they look a more normal appearance. And that seems like a subtle thing. And some people might think, well, it's probably not necessary. The kid just needs to toughen up. But the way society is and norms, this had a huge effect on that kid's confidence and comfort level when he goes to school.
Yeah, I would imagine we'll have an impact on the rest of his life.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, like you were saying, with even the government and the military, I'll have a lot of kids that will go through kind of a rebellious phase, and they'll have very large, you know, earrings and grommets and things like that. And you can't get in the military now by having large grommets in your ears. So I'll do ear reconstruction so that they're able to go into the military and make some real positive changes in their life.
So I want to talk a little bit more about, you know, your practice as a surgeon, and then get back to some of this, like what I think will be fun to compare professions. I've heard people want to come in and say, I want to look like nothing's been done. First of all, what does that mean? And secondly, how do you do that?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I do hear that a lot. The first thing I usually explain to them is what they probably mean by that is they want it to look natural, because a lot of people say they want to look like nothing's been done. But if you think about it, by definition, the reason they're going to have a procedure is because they want to look a little improved, and they want to look a little more youthful, a little more rested. And so I kind of explained to them that the goal is to look natural and not look what we call surgical, which is kind of that pulled, stretched look you see on TV sometimes. And the way that I'm able to really obtain that result for them is because of my specialty background through ophthalmology first. I understand all the minute angles and the millimeters that are needed around the eye to make them look natural. And it's the same thing around the mouth. If you can make the eyes and the mouth look natural, and you adjust the framework of the face, then people look just like themselves, but they look like a little bit younger, more refreshed version.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. was I unwise to leave them open for so long?
And that's really the goal and the definition of good plastic surgery. I saw a lady yesterday that was kind of teasing and saying, you know, she went to a family reunion and everybody told her how great she looked, but, you know, nobody knew that she had a facelift and she had her eyes done. And I said, well, actually, that's a big compliment to you, because what you want is to look great but not look like you've had surgery. To me, the best results I have are the ones where people don't know that somebody's actually had surgery.
So you've done 25,000 surgeries?
Yes.
Like that? How did you find time to write a book? And then what is your thought now that it's been completed?
Well, it was certainly my motivation to do it was for the troubled teens and to raise money. And so that helped once I got about halfway into it, because if it wasn't for that motivation, I don't think I would have completed it. It took me about 3.5 years to do it and do life at the same time. And I did not realize that it'd be such an undertaking, but at the same time, I wanted to make sure that it was something that I felt good about and something that I was proud of. And that's how I feel now. I do feel like that it's a very good educational piece that people can get a lot out of. And I'm really excited about being able to use it as a springboard for the Face Change Foundation.
Yeah. Well, and my personal interest outside of always being curious about entrepreneurship and, of course, knowing where you come from and your intent is that at Sidewalk Radio, we explore community and we do it contextually, oftentimes through culture and sometimes through the physical development in our city and the landscape. But when you are talking about programs that help kids, you're really helping communities. And so I'd like to just talk a minute about that and kind of with more of that Sidewalk Radio focus for a moment.
Sure. Well, you know, it's really interesting. I've always enjoyed, you know, I've been a camp counselor for a couple of summers, and I've done scouting. I've worked with the Big Brother program through a lot of your interests that you introduced me to. And I'm a big believer in, you know, you want your community to feel like a small town. And the only way you can really do that in a large city like Atlanta is to get involved. And so that's certainly an emphasis of mine and something I try to live by example to my own family. So just along with the interest side that Sidewalk Radio has, I feel like this book is similar to that in that it could be something that can be important to a community. And like, for instance, people that want to have surgery, there's a lot of people right now that have the means and the interest to have surgery, but they might feel a little guilty. I kind of joke around and call it Catholic guilt. It's where somebody wants to have surgery, but they see things going on in the news and things like that, and they don't feel like they're doing what's best for their community. It might be best for them, but they don't feel like they're helping the community by doing that. Well, this is a way where they can do what's best for them, feel good about it, and also feel good because they're supporting their community through the Troubled Teen Program.
And $300,000, I mean, like, we kind of glossed over it, but that is a lot of money. And especially, like, we all know what's happened in the last 6 or 7 years. The economy hasn't been stellar. You know, you clearly, like, believe in it. That's a big statement. But you've been doing that for your career, right?
I have.
And I want to know, like, a couple of examples, but also I want to know, like, why.
You know, my mother worked at Barksdale Air Force Base when I was growing up, and there were a lot of situations that we would talk about, you know, whether they would be single moms or, you know, people that didn't have opportunities that we had. And you know, and I grew up in a you know, middle-class home, and it's kind of funny when we took our kids back to Louisiana, and my oldest son was about 8, he goes, "Wow, Dad, I didn't know you lived in a prototype home." And I was so impressed that he even knew what the word prototype was. But it really kind of showed us that, you know, humble beginnings can lead to that passion. So it's been something that I think both my wife and I have a special interest in, you know, helping people that don't have some of the opportunities we did. Yeah. And although we both feel like we've created a lot of the things we have, a lot of people, it's not that they don't want to try hard and do things and help their community, but they either don't know the resources or have the resources, or they don't have the education to know what to do to support their community or themselves.
Yeah. So, you know, I've been kind of dying to get to this part since the beginning. What was the draw to architecture, and then what is the similarities between what you do? Because I think people might be interested and surprised to hear.
Sure. You know, my draw to architecture is really the precision of different, you know, angles and shades and changes to take something that is modern and make it look like it's been there for a long time. So I really like architecture that has, it looks like it's timeless. And that's certainly the goal that I have with surgery is I like to, like for instance, I always say that a millimeter makes a difference between success or failure around the eyes, whereas an inch makes a difference with the rest of the face. And what I mean by that is, if one corner of your eyelid is up a millimeter more than the other side, it's going to make you look a little different. You're not going to look like yourself. And a lot of times people don't really appreciate that. I'll have people come in and they'll say, you know, I went elsewhere and I had a blepharoplasty done, but I'm just not happy. And immediately I can see that they're a millimeter off. And so it's really the details and the precision that I think they have so much in common.
Well, why don't we tell, just for the, we're going to have this on our website too, but why don't we tell people where to buy it? Because that's a good thing, and they can help face change the organization. And then we'll kind of conclude with a little bit more on the family front.
Sure. The book is available through Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And it's also available. We have a link on our website. And if you are very eager and you don't want to wait a couple of days to get it from Amazon, it's available at our office. And our office is over near Pill Hill, right by Northside and St. Joseph Hospital.
And what's the website address?
The website address is oculusplasticsurgery.com.
And we'll have that on the post for this on our site. I grew up, as you know, with the Manning brothers in New Orleans, and that was a lot of fun. They would be out like running line drills. I would be sleeping in waiting for the donuts to arrive. But you know, as you can imagine, I mean, they get called by everyone to do radio interviews, television interviews, magazines, the whole deal. ESPN wanted to do the Book of Manning.
Right.
And Archie said, I don't want to do this. So the story goes. and Olivia said, well, why not? And he's like, you know, I'm just tired. I've done a lot of these, and it's like, it can kind of, you know, the story's kind of out there. And she said, well, you know, this one's going to be kind of put together, and it'll be great, and tell the whole story and involve the kids. And he said, you know, I just don't want to do that. And she said, well, you're not doing it for you. You're doing it for your kids and for your grandkids. And then it became like, you know, and so it is really nice. And I know some people who wish like that they had more of their parent, be it on television or like getting back to the Billy Crystal thing. He had a couple of home movies and a couple of old black and white photos. So I like the idea too of like doing these types of interviews that are more personal, talking more about family that generations like your three young grandkids can listen to. And so I thought it'd be fun if we just concluded with any type of special message to them.
Sure. I think, well, first of all, I think that's a great sentiment. And I am very proud as a grandfather. You know, everybody says it's a great time in your life. And I'm only 54. And to be a G-pop at 54, it means the world to me. So, you know, my goal really for them is for me to walk my talk and to teach them by not what I say, but really what I do. And I think by contributing to the community and making decisions that are based around my family, taking care of patients, we've always had a policy that no matter what a person's financial resources are or insurance situation, that we'll take care of them with any kind of medical issue that they have. And that's been my policy for 25 years. And I'm proud of that. And I think that there's a lot of doctors out there that do a lot for the community. And I also honestly feel like there's a lot of doctors out there that should do more for their community. And I can't very well expect other people to do it if I don't walk my talk. And so my real message for them would be to walk your talk and to be proud of it. And don't only walk your talk when people are looking, but more importantly, walk your talk when you're alone.
It's a great message for us all. Thank you for joining.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed it.